You are listening to KBOO Portland. We are about 10 seconds away from 10 o'clock. That was A Different Nature with your host, Chris Merrick, tonight. Coming up next is Poetry Potluck Radio Hour with your host, Neil Aiken.
KBOO listeners, come check out an art exhibit about the standoff at Standing Rock, entitled For Those Yet to Come, Water is Life, in Studio One at KBOO, your community radio station, 20 Southeast 8th Street in Portland, Oregon. KBOO volunteer Christopher Francisco was on site at Standing Rock for most of the struggle, and he shares with our community some of the firsthand photos of what he witnessed. Stop by KBOO during the month of September to check out the exhibit.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Mount Hood Community Conservation and Repair Fair, Saturday, October 7th at 11 a.m. at Mount Hood Community College in Gresham. The Mount Hood Community Conservation and Repair Fair will feature workshops, information, free resources, a repair cafe, local resources, and activities for kids. Again, that's Mount Hood Community Conservation and Repair Fair, Saturday, October 7th at 11 a.m. at Mount Hood Community College, 26000 Southeast Dark Street in Gresham. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you for your pause, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
We want to thank everyone who joined or renewed your membership during our fall membership drive here at KBOO. We came very close to our $105,000 goal. We were within $10,000 of it. If you have not donated, please do so. Go to the website kboo.fm/give. Thanks again for supporting the best radio station on earth, KBOO.
Thank you for your pause, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
Hello, welcome tonight to our second Poetry Potluck Radio Hour. I'm your host tonight, Neil Aiken, and our guests tonight are going to be Geneva Chow and Julian Smuggles. Let's bring on our first guest.
Hi, Neil.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
I'm fine. I'm in beautiful Lincoln Heights, California, watching the moon. How are you?
Pretty good. So this is, I guess, the first of our incarnations as Poetry Potluck Radio Hour. I think we had a different name last time we came on, and I wonder sometimes if we're going to keep changing. But we are grateful that you could join us tonight. I was wondering if you would, our first guest here, Geneva Chow, stands out as being both a translator and an author of several books of poetry. Her most recent collection is forthcoming, is a multilingual book, Emigre, which will be published by Tinfish in 2018. And she has work in Best American Experimental Poetry and various journals. I was wondering if you could perhaps provide us with some insight or some sort of background that we might not get from your average bio.
First
you, and then perhaps then we'll shift to the Poetry Potluck portion, where we expect our guests to bring us something unexpected, a surprise dish.
All right. Well, you know, Neil, as you know, and probably as a lot of our listeners have experienced, I think that my linguistic background is, you know, is problematized by the fact that, you know, I don't really have a mother tongue, or at least I don't have a father tongue. And, you know, my parents are obviously immigrants. My father immigrated from China as a small boy, and, you know, so he lost his first language. And, you know, I grew up speaking the language of the adopted country. And, you know, and that was always very interesting to me because it was apparent in the way he spoke. And it was, you know, he spoke perfect English. He speaks perfect English. He doesn't have an accent. You know, nobody would ever know except, you know, except for these, you know, there are these weird lacunae in his speech. You know, there are these, you know, sort of strange, obvious things that a native speaker would know that sometimes he seemed, you know, he's managed to go 6 years now without figuring out. Or, you know, he will use the Chinese words, the Chinese baby language words for, you know, things like pee-pee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which, as you probably know, is shishi. So, you know, so there's a, you know, so there's a lot of there's a lot of palimpsest in my family, and my mother is a Californian, but her family is originally of French extraction, and so, you know, there's all of this sort of overwriting of French and English, and then English and Chinese, and so, you know, translation was kind of a natural thing for me because it was a way to, you know, try and, I think, you know, a way to put together all of the pieces of an identity that you have into some more coherent whole.
Mm-hmm. So I really like this idea of the palimpsest, which you play with. Did this idea originate? Can you point to a particular moment where you kind of stumbled upon this idea of the palimpsest as sort of a way of making sense of this type of overwriting of languages?
Well, I studied calligraphy growing up, and, you know, so, and I was, you know, particularly interested in medieval calligraphy, which, you know, was done on vellum, and actually, I mean, that is where the word comes from. You would do, you know, a manuscript, and then if you needed to repurpose that expensive animal skin for another one, you would scrape it clean, you know, but there are always traces of the original underneath, you know, and so that very much became the way I thought of my father's understanding of language. I remember one time when I was probably 14 or 15, and my sister asked him what solace meant, and he said, being alone. And I was like, Dad, that's not what that means. But it was really interesting to me because, you know, it was a totally defensible, educated guess from somebody who, you know, went to Berkeley and Stanford and grew up in California for the most part, but who, you know, had probably never heard that word used and who, you know, is an engineer and, you know, not much of a reader. So, you know, despite having an excellent command of the language, you know, he was just like, well, I know the Latin root, so I'll guess something that's totally wrong. And, you know, and I just saw sort of the shallowness of that top layer at that moment.
Mm-hmm. My father was a librarian and an archivist. So the idea of a palimpsest is something, you know, I've encountered through him and through his introduction. You know, he introduced me to different books and manuscripts and things like that over time. And then I also think about it sometimes in relation to I think sometimes of Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose and sort of manuscripts and books and layers and layers upon meaning, you know, and what gets hidden, you know, in these manuscripts.
Right.
And there
right,
is,
and of course, everything gets hidden.
Yeah,
you know, is the answer to that question.
And yet, it's never completely hidden. There's always things that slip out or cannot be fully erased. You know, my mother is the same way. I hear in her language sometimes, you know, these little artifacts, these little traces, you know, within her English that kind of resemble or remind me of things that, having subsequently learned Chinese, learned Mandarin, you'll see little places where it creeps out unexpectedly.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of that? I'm curious.
I'm
not the only one.
I'm trying to think of, like, this is a little, I think those specific examples sometimes are harder to trace. I can think of little moments where she has halfway mastered a particular idiom in English and somehow has made it make sense, even though it's not the idiom that I know. So she'll sometimes tell me, she'll send me an email and say, here's another jam of wisdom instead of a gem. I think, well, it is kind of a preserve and it is kind of a condensed thing. It's like, I kind of like this idea, but it is a jam of wisdom.
Right.
So
that wisdom has been boiled down and sterilized.
Yeah, it's like, she's right. I feel like I'm not going to quibble. I think she's right. It is a jam of wisdom.
Yeah, that's excellent. I love that. Yeah, well, I did not grow up around Chinese speakers for the most part. My extended family, some of the members of it do still speak Chinese, but they are all in the Bay Area, and I was in Portland as a child, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I didn't figure out that my dad's saying shishi for when you had to go to the bathroom when you were a little kid was Chinese until I was like 20. And I was like, oh, I get it. You can't say anything else, can you? Like, I never heard him say anything else for that. That was...
That sounds as bad as... My Chinese got forgotten. Like, I learned it when I was 3.5, 4 years old, and then forgot it when we came back to Canada, you know, after living in Taiwan. And for years, you know, I operated with just the barest remains of the language. I could count to 8. I couldn't even count to a full 10. I knew my name, but I always mispronounced it. And it's funny, even after I relearned the language, it is still hard to overcome sort of the ways in which you have grown up mangling your own name.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm not even going to try to pronounce my Chinese name. I mean, I think I can do it, but I'm sure there are people out there listening who would put me to shame. So I can write it. But, you know, it's also very much an erasure for me in my personal family history, because my grandmother died in China. And so there is no, you know, there's no mother figure coming down through that line at all. Mm. There were only men. There was only my father and his two brothers and his father, you know, who appeared in this country.
So only men came over.
Yeah. Only men came over with all of, you know, the particularities of their language and their limitations and their sort of cultural touchstones, and, you know, especially in 1948, which is when they came over. You know, so there are whole swaths of culture that are lost. You know, we've talked about, you know, maybe that's the next thing to touch on, is the sort of, you know, the expectations, you know, sort of ethnic expectations of a writer.
Mm.
And, you know, and how, you know, there has been for some time, and there is even more now, I think, a really strong emphasis on identity and on expressing your identity in the writing community, and on, you know, and a little bit, you know, almost on performing that, in the sense that you're trying to, you know, assert something that's been too long denied. I think very often, you know, like, people were assimilating, they were, you know, and they were feeling, you know, really restricted by assimilationist culture. And so, you know, now it's, I'm going to express that. I'm going to give voice to all of these different words and all of these origin words and all of my origin languages. You know, and I just translated a really interesting work by a Vietnamese I can't say Vietnamese American because some of them are Vietnamese French. But, you know, Vietnamese origin women's collective called She Who Has No Master. And it was very interesting because, you know, it was really an interrogation of all of the ways that that identity gets transmuted or trespassed or transformed, you know, by the host country. But in, you know, but in the case of someone like me, who's a hybrid, you know, a lot of those expectations are wrong, and that's where we, or aren't accessible. That's where we get back to the, you know, the sort of invisible, you know, the invisible mothers on the Chinese side of my family. You know, because the biggest association people have with Chinese American literature is Amy Tan's famous mother cutting off a chunk of her arm and dropping it into the soup to heal her ailing daughter. Remember that? Like, you know, because that's what being Chinese is about. It's about villages and poverty and diaspora and soup and superstitions. And, you know, I mean, my mom's like, here, have this brie. and I don't... I cannot imagine her either successfully making soup or cutting off a chunk of her arm and putting it in there. Sorry, Mom.
Well, on that note, we'll pause briefly to say that this is Poetry Potluck Radio Hour. I'm your host, Neil Akin, and we are in the middle of a conversation with Geneva Chow about apparently cutting off parts of our arms and putting it into soup, or poetry, as the case may be. So continuing this...
I think that was just redundant of you, Neil.
It's totally redundant. I think that's what we all do, is chop off pieces of ourselves and put it into a soup, boil it down like a jam or like a preserve of some sort, and hand it off to other people, expecting them to be nourished.
Really we're hoping done. That we're done. Actually going to spread it on something.
I think that you've raised some really interesting, deep issues here with the problem of erasure and the problem of expectation for the ways in which we're supposed to perform our ethnicity or this expectation that we perform in a ways that resonate or connect with what others want us to be. So when you announce yourself or identify yourself, or others choose to identify you as Asian American or as Chinese American, or even as someone who's hybrid, a mix of different cultures, there are certain narratives that they want to impose on us or our families.
Yeah, very, very much. You know, and one of those narratives is always, you know, where is the village and what were the superstitions? And I think we impose that on ourselves. You know, my mom, being a well-meaning Berkeley, former Berkeley student, gave me, you know, in addition to, you know, constantly cooking lentils and, you know, eschewing white sugar, she also, you know, went to great lengths to provide me with Chinese American literature so that I could, I don't know, presumably know who I was or at least know who other people were who had similar heritage. You know, so I read Maxine Hong Kingston very young and, you know, and I love Maxine Hong Kingston, but, you know, anybody who's read The Woman Warrior knows that it's about misogyny.
Yeah.
It's all about menstrual shame. That entire book is about all of the ways in which your uterus can make you miserable and ashamed and shunned and, you know, plugging up a well with your, you know, suicidal desperation and, you know, or hiding your, whatever, your dirty rags from your family. And, you know, that's another, you know, very complicated piece because people now are exploding the notion of identity and they're examining this idea of intersectionality. You know, but at the same time, none of the categories and none of the ways we define them is adequate at all. And it's very often a really tragic misfit. You know, I avoid in my bios, I go to ridiculous lengths to avoid gendered pronouns. And the reason that I do that is that I don't like them. But another reason that I do that is that growing up, my dad always called me his firstborn son, which I'm pretty sure that's you. Not my dad, but I'm pretty sure you're the firstborn son. So you kind of have an idea of how unusual it is for particularly a Chinese person to say that to somebody who not only is not their first child, but who, you know, was identified as female at birth.
I think it is unusual. I also think my own family history is complicated in that respect, because I feel like my mother came from a family where, with the exception of her mother, the women were the strong figures and the men often were weak. And so I grew up in sort of a setting where the stories of who was the hero or who was, even in my own family, who was the disciplinarian was actually my mother. And she was the one that administered justice and punishment, but she was also the one who controlled the finances and the one was sort of the clear head. My father was much more of the person that was generous and affectionate and displayed emotion more publicly and easily. And I think my mother was more reserved in that. And then it took a while to kind of figure out what she was doing that communicated that same depth of love, but not always in obvious ways, or at least ways that we'd been trained to read. But, you know, when I talk to my relatives, it's kind of one of the things I discovered is that actually she is greatly revered in the family because she basically raised the family with her mother not really playing a strong role.
Huh. Well, you know, that is an interesting thing, and it's something I think that a lot of Americans don't know about China or Chinese culture, and I'm just going to drop some knowledge because, you know, I got so sick of people assuming that I knew everything about China because I was so Chinese that I just, you know, decided to read it. And that way I would be able to answer their questions. So if you want to know about feng shui, you know, come to me. But, you know, one of the things that I find really fascinating about Chinese family structure historically is that there is this idea of the uxora local and the uxora nomial family, you know, which is when the mother, the woman's name, the man takes the woman's name. You know, particularly, you know, in cases where the woman's family is higher status or, you know, has more of an inheritance or of, you know, or some kind of cultural inheritance to pass on. And where the man will move into the woman's family's house as opposed to vice versa and sort of, and become, you know, a part of that family, become subsumed into that family. You know, and then of course, a lot of people don't know that, you know, even today, Chinese women don't typically change their names when they get married, you know, which I'm sure you know, but
yeah.
I think that, you know, people assume that because they don't think of China as a very feminist country in a lot of ways, you know, except for that overlay of communism, they assume that, you know, that must not be the case and that women's identity is completely, you know, overwritten by their husbands. But, you know, in many very obvious ways, that's not true at all.
No.
And so I think that, you know, the relationships of culture to gender are much more complex than people realize.
So we've got about like 3 minutes, 2 or 3 minutes. Well, we should start heading towards some sort of ending here. So I was wondering, like, as we're looking at the clock, I know you wanted to talk a bit about your forthcoming book, and we've kind of been dancing around a lot of these issues that are related to the book. So what is this book and when is it coming out?
It's coming out in spring of 2018 from Tin Fish Press, which is run out of Hawaii by the miraculous Susan Schultz, and which has published a lot of other really beautiful books, some by Portland writers, Kaya Sand, I believe Jules Boykoff, have books with Tin Fish. You know, and Tinfish Press is interesting because it has an emphasis on sort of trans-Pacific literature. I don't know if that's the right word I'm using, but I think it's the right concept, you know. And so this book, Emigre, is about, obviously, emigration and its after effects, but it's particularly about the linguistic, you know, sort of potluck, if you will, or collage or palimpsest that happens when you emigrate and when your language gets overwritten by the sort of by the vernacular of the host country, and also about, you know, the terrible loss that is, and the terrible lack that it causes in you. You know, I don't know how you feel about languages, but it happens to me frequently when I'm speaking English that there's something that I can only say in French, you know, which is very frustrating. And it also happens to me less frequently because I think I actually just don't express my emotions in English very much. So it happens less frequently, but it also happens in French that there's something that I, you know, just can't say except in English. You know, one of my best friends who I grew up with is French American, and so we can have these wonderfully seamless conversations, but that's not possible with most people. And then, of course, even with someone like that, who you have, you know, you have a total cognate and almost twin who has this really similar experience and this really similar quantity of input linguistically, different things get overwritten. You know, it's like a glitch in a script.
And
you can't predict what's going to be lost. And so I'll say something and he'll be like, what are you talking about? Or he'll say something and I'll say, that's not French. You can't say that.
There's a similarity, but it's not quite the same. I think about my mother's family is a complex family linguistically. They grew up speaking Mandarin, Cantonese, Taiwanese, Hakkanese, and many of them also studied English. And so when you hear them in conversation, they are code switching like crazy in their conversation. It's near impossible to understand them when they get excited about something and they switch between all the languages. And it's like a code that only they understand.
Right, like you would need actually 7 or 8 UN translators there to help you deal with this family dinner.
And I learned that my grandmother, who grew up speaking Cantonese, actually speaks not Cantonese. It's actually she spoke Mandarin as well, but her Mandarin had such a strong, strange accent to it that it was incomprehensible even to other Mandarin speakers often. And so I came back after 2 years in Taiwan. I thought, finally, I'll be able to have a conversation with my grandmother. And I realized, it was like, I'm still only getting about 25-30% in the conversation.
But
it is fascinating in which, you know, our personalities, our identities even shift, as we change with language.
Yes, very much. And then we create this idiolect, which is our own particular, like your mother's jam of wisdom, our own particular sort of adaptation of all of these different elements we have. And so, so the book is an investigation of that. And it's also really kind of, it's kind of a parti pris, it's kind of a parti pris for this sort of the plight of the immigrant in the sense that you are living in the absence of home constantly. And as much as you might want to be wherever you are, I don't think that humans are really built in a way where they cannot feel that absence and sometimes feel it really keenly and other times require, kind of a lot of internal mental wall building in order to survive that situation. And so the book investigates that, and it also investigates particularly through the kind of the experience of two sort of streams of immigrants that I know, one of which is Chinese Americans who came through Hawaii, and many of whom were sojourner workers in Hawaii, and who, thus were, having all of these different, linguistic influences, of course, various different dialects of Chinese and English and Hawaiian and some Spanish and Filipino, Tagalog, and other Filipino languages, and just and Japanese and Korean, you know, all in this sort of atmosphere of privation, of social privation, in the sense that, you know, it was mostly men who were alone, who were working, and who, you know, were sending money home and planning to go home, but very often it was a decade before that actually happened. And then the other experience is the experience of European immigrants who have come to the U.S., and in particular of a family that I know who emigrated from Guernsey in the Channel Islands, which is, you know, Guernsey's part of Great Britain, but it is historically a French-speaking place. Mm. And the local language, local patois, they call it, is basically a variant of Norman French. So if you speak French, you can understand a lot of it. And then sometimes there are these crazy words that don't seem to, you know, make any sense at all. And so the book is, you know, sort of gathers all these ribbons together of Guernsey French and French and English and Hawaiian and, you know, these, and vestigial Chinese, and sort of weaves them, you know, into... I've had it described as a really long love poem, but I think it's also a lament.
Mm. It's kind of an elegy then, perhaps?
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. I would love to go on with this conversation, but unfortunately we've hit our time. So if people want to find more information about you and about the books that you've published, you've written already, and the translation work that you've done, and we didn't even really get into translation in this conversation, where can they go online to find out more about you, your work, and how to order your books?
They can go to my website, which is GenevaChao.com, GenevaChao.com, and there are links to, you know, the various books and presses, and, you know, and some journals and things like that.
Okay.
Upcoming events.
Well, it's been a delight to talk with you, and we're so glad that you've been on the show. I wish we had a little bit more time that we could actually hear a little bit more of the poetry, but we will catch you on a different time, and perhaps we'll have more time to talk about the poetry.
Sounds good, Neil. It was great talking to you.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Okay.
Bye. Welcome back to Poetry Potluck Radio Hour. I'm your host, Neil Akin. We just finished a conversation with Geneva Chao, and we are now on to our second guest, Julian Smuggles, a local Portland-based poet, writer, and I don't know, entrepreneur?
Something like that, probably.
Extravaganza? I don't know. So, Julian... Julian is a Chicano artist from San Jose, California. Their work is like an all-black Adidas tracksuit, which I hope they will explain in more detail. They are part of a Dim Summer book club, a small press based out of Portland. Their chapbook, You're So Trippin', is now out. And their work has appeared in Heart House Review, Toad the Journal, and Fix My Head. Welcome to KBOO, KBOO, and and welcome to Poetry Potluck Radio Hour.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. It's not often that you get to talk about poetry in like a more serious context, even though I describe myself as like an Adidas tracksuit of poetry.
Do you want to explain what exactly that means, or is that part of the air of mystery you wish to preserve?
No, I can explain. I think that poetry has a tendency to sort of be off-putting, and there's sort of this pseudo air of mystique around it and seriousness where everybody pretends that they know a poet or read some sort of poetry, but I don't really think that people do, and I don't really think that it's really accessible in a lot of ways, or easily digestible, especially what's popular. And so for me, at least, the way that I relate to it is the way that I kind of express myself through my clothing and my general aesthetic or something, is like I want it to be comfortable, and I want it to be something that like harkens back to what previous generations have worn to or done to. Mm. And it's important for me to be in conversation with that and kind of realize that, like, although it can be academic or it can be more serious or something, that I don't always have to take myself too seriously, and I should try to remember like where I came from or what was actually important to me that drove me to writing or sort of arts in general.
That's a really interesting way to look at it. But it doesn't imply that you have corporate sponsors.
No, I wish. I mean, if anybody knows anybody from Adidas, hook it up. That would be tight.
One can only hope, or maybe not. Maybe we're not ready yet to sell out. We chose poetry after all.
Yeah.
The place where it's hardest to sell out.
Where you can't even buy in, right?
You can't find an agent to represent you because there's no money in it.
No.
So this being Poetry Potluck Hour, one of the things we ask our guests, and you, if you have something, it's great. If not, we'll just launch into the rest of the discussion. Do you have something to share? Did you bring something odd, mysterious, interesting, other than the tracksuit to share?
Yeah, I did. So I've been kind of thinking about memory, and I have like a pretty interesting lack of a relationship with my father. So I'll read sort of things that I've been thinking about and sort of mulling over about that. And it's like, I think with most memory things, some of it's true and some of it's not true. So I guess take it kind of with a grain of salt, and I'll just get into it. I used to have a dad, but don't anymore because of legal reasons related to child support. When I had a dad, his name was Jimmy. My mom, Marilyn, tells me that Jimmy would spend nights trying to convince her that when I was born, that I should also be named Jimmy. They would cruise down El Camino Real in a light blue Dodge Dart, listening to Depeche Mode, their favorite band at the time. The streets a mixture of apricot orchards and the seeds of various tech companies. Jimmy would drive even though the car belonged to my mom. Marilyn had spent the pre-senior year summer before getting pregnant working on the 1964 car with my grandfather, Tim. Tim and Marilyn are no longer talking in the spring of 1988 when the conversations about my potential name take place. Tim from Detroit has spent most of his life working in the auto industry and carries with him a desire for everything to have a simple break and a series of repairs. It has been implied over the years that Tim urged Marilyn to get an abortion, a solution for the error in judgment made. Cruising refers to the social practice of teens slowly, sometimes yelling at other teens of the opposite sex out of a car. By 1995, the city of San Jose would crack down and outlaw the practice due to congestion concerns. I first learned of these nights, a few of the only stories Marilyn shares about Jimmy, when I offhandedly described to her parking lot pimping, a term I wouldn't use now, but was a common mode of partying when I was a similar age to her cruising age. My friends and I would slowly caravan around, accumulating people like a swarm of jellyfish, eventually settling in a currentless parking lot. We would blast hyphy music from the car with the best stereo and drink Mad Dog 2020. As I write this, I wonder how much of an impact a name can have on a person. In 1948, two Harvard professors did a study of graduating men from the university to see if their name could be used to predict their success in academic life. The study had a theory that the more unusual a name, the more likely the person was to drop out of the university or have mental health issues. Jimmy Smuggles, Julian Smuggles. I imagine my mom and former dad, their legs sticking to the leather interior of the rebuilt car, older than both of them. Marilyn unsatisfied at Safeway in the sandwich department. She would talk about John Lennon and his son Julian Lennon, even though I've never heard her mention the Beatles before. But I know that my grandpa Tim enjoys them because he let me go through his record collection once. My mom would push her brown bangs out of her eyes at the red light, and Jimmy would drive with his arm out the window, hand always touching the roof, tapping with the beat of People Are People.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you. That's a really rich, like, tableau. Like, it brings us into that. Brings us into that moment and that history, and into those spaces. Was there a particular reason that you were drawn to this, that you were thinking about this particular memory and its associations? Especially, like, the names thing seems like a really interesting thing to talk about.
Yeah. So as like somebody that's like first generation or trying to force you to sort of assimilate to American culture in San mm-hmm. Jose, during the 80s, where there's like a lot of racial tension happening, and the sort of city was sort of transitioning from being like an agricultural based city to more of a tech based city, and there was a sort of a lot of strife and conflict happening. It's interesting to me what familial pushes and where things pull and try to force kids into. And I think that the name was a signifier of wanting me to feel connected to the family, but at the same time, it's like a pretty American sounding name and something that I think had been adopted. Like, I had an uncle named Jimmy. Like, I think I had a cousin named Jimmy. Like, everybody was named Jimmy.
Do you know the origins of it? Like, was it tracing back to a particular person that the name was being drawn from, and sort of the ethos around that? Or was it that it had its own Americanicity? I don't know. But it felt extremely American, like Jimmy Stewart,
Yeah.
That type of thing that we'd like gravitate towards a particular celebrity and say, oh, they felt very American, therefore this name feels like it would imbue Americanness to whoever holds it.
Yeah, I think that it came down to what was the most American sounding name. And I think it was reflected in like my grandparents not wanting to teach me Spanish so that I wouldn't have an accent, and sort of just like a, we're here now, this is our life. We're Americans, we're going to be Americans, and we don't want anyone to know where we're originally from, if possible. So we're going to do whatever we can to adopt things.
Well, that sounds so, like, historically, that sounds so familiar, right? If you've studied the history of the Japanese internment and sort of Japanese-American experience, there was a whole generation of people that thought, we have to get rid of everything and become as American as possible. And it still didn't work.
No, it'll never work. Yeah. I mean, I look different. So.
It's like there's a surprise. Like, oh, yeah.
I'm brown. Gotcha. Yeah.
I was reading, sort of some of the preview you sent of this particular piece. And I was thinking about the ways in which, like, names do go on through families, but they often have different meanings. My name, Neil, actually has a very... Mm-hmm. Long, well, not super long, but it has a longish history in our family. I too have a uncle who is a Neil, and my grandfather. So my uncle is Malcolm Neil Aiken. My grandfather was George Neil Aiken, and had a brother, Robert Neil, I think. And then it goes back a generation past that. And what happened was that there was someone in the family who married Elizabeth Neil, the last of her line. And the two families made an arrangement that the name Neil would be preserved generation after generation. And so I'm grateful that it was Neil and not some other name.
Right.
It's like, I could live with that. I could live with this particular history for the name. But I do think it's like our assumptions about why someone carries a particular name may be completely wrong. We may not understand sort of why someone has that name.
Right. And the legacy and sort of heritage within the family can be so insular too, of just like carrying on the family in that way or something. And that's not necessarily what people actively think about now when they think about names or like taking on somebody else's name or who they're naming, of like how important family is or something, or carrying on that tradition in a certain way.
Do you feel like a name has power?
Yeah, I think so. I think that my life would probably be way different if I was named Jimmy. And I think, I mean, I actively choose. My last name is not really Smuggles. I actively chose to rename myself that.
Mm-hmm.
In part because I wanted to distance myself from my dad, but also because I just wanted to have some control over my life and who I was and to be able to define myself in certain ways.
There's an interesting tradition in China when it comes to names. And I know this because this is actually what happened with I learned about this with relation to Chinese names and how they're chosen. And traditionally what you would do is you'd go to a fortune teller or oracle, and they would cast your horoscope. So you bring your child, or you say, I have a child that's about to be born. Well, actually, they have to be born because you need to know the birth date
right.
and the time. And then they cast your horoscope. And then whatever name that the family has chosen, the fortune teller will then look it over and compare it with the horoscope and determine which elements are missing, deficit in your horoscope, and then modify the characters of your name to new homophonic, well, usually homophonic, but at least characters that have the same general sound and meaning. Mm-hmm. Not always meaning, but change to the same sound with different radicals that indicate like the different elements that are missing. So like you might swap something in with a wood radical to emphasize some sort of like to compensate for a lack that's in your horoscope. Usually it's money. Usually
right.
It's like, oh, your deficit in your gold radical, your metal radical. So therefore we will have to add
it
more.
Always is money, right?
It's always money. But sometimes it's other things. Sometimes
yeah, yeah.
It's like spirit or heart, you know, and something mm-hmm. like that. And they'll find like a corresponding one. So like I had no idea it was so complex, but
yeah.
It's like it becomes extremely important. And they can change the whole point is that they can change your destiny, your fate, by correcting your name.
Right.
And they'll even say that. They'll say, like, if you have had really bad luck for a long period of time, go to the fortune teller and determine what's missing and change your name
yeah.
so that you will have better fortune in the future.
Yeah, there's another study, that Harvard study that I mentioned, talked about there was a correlation between people with unusual names and dropping out of the university. But then there's a more recent study in Baltimore and in Chicago that was using names that sounded more African American or Black as opposed to white in terms of getting jobs. And, you know, one out of 10 of the white resumes that they had constructed, all other variables the same, would get called back, where it would be 1 out of 15 for a more like ethnic sounding name or something. And I think...
And the content of the resume would be exactly the same.
Yeah, which is crazy. And then I've also kind of just been thinking about, I recently went to Barcelona, which is like also sort of in the news, and like there's kind of craziness happening. But I went to Barcelona and like thinking about Spanish imperialism and colonization of Mexico and sort of how that has an effect on mm-hmm. names and language and what's popularized there. And sort of what indigenous culture was like before that and the language that was lost or the names that were lost sort of in that process. So there was like assimilation upon assimilation, you know, that was taking place.
This is starting to echo sort of our earlier conversation, you know, the conversation we had with Geneva Chow.
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea of overwriting and palimpsest is that
yeah.
it's like this process of assimilation is also a process of erasure and overwriting.
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. So, is this turning into a larger project for you?
Yeah. I think it's interesting because I hadn't really thought about and kind of don't really, I'm not really super, have been super interested in my family tree or my heritage in that sort of way. Mm-hmm. But I also think that there's a lot that I've been missing out on of sort of what it meant to be a Mexican American, mm-hmm. In California at that time. And it's sort of thinking about the impact that immigration has had and migrant workers in the United States and like why people choose and chose to come to the United States and what laws or what things sort of changed the dynamics that happened between the U.S. and Mexico in terms of people being able to freely go across the border, mm-hmm. For migrant workers and why and how that had an effect on why my family chose to stay, mm-hmm. and sort of how I became to exist. And mm-hmm. It's complicated and I don't really have necessarily a good feeling or answer of what I should be feeling about that, but I've been sort of investigating that. And I think it all has to do with sort of assimilating in the 1980s seems like really, really crazy and like a particularly hard time. And I don't think it's ever been easy. I think it's always been hard. But there's like a definite turning point, I think, for at least in the Mexican-American sort of tradition of things being way more racialized in the language of around sort of Mexican workers, mm. and sort of like this fear that had been growing since the 50s of like Mexican people are going to take our jobs or something like that, and why my family chose to sort of reject the Mexican heritage and roots to sort of try to become the best Americans they could be, mm-hmm. at the time, given the circumstances that presented themselves, and sort of what I lost out on in those moments and the things that I wish I could take back. But I just don't really have the lens or something to even really know them sometimes.
It's hard. I mean, it's how do you find what you've lost and didn't know you were missing?
Right.
Like, how do you begin to identify that? This is a real struggle. I hear you when you say it's complicated, you don't know how to do it, and yet it also is continuing to bear on your mind, which feels to me like, well, then it's obviously the next project.
Yeah. It's what I've been working on. It's one of those things where I think, I don't know, I can't speak for anyone but myself, but my own experience, like as a writer, I kind of wrote from a blank background, which was like an assumed white mm-hmm. narrator or active person or something. And at some point, similar to the conversation before, you choose to sort of reject that and it becomes sort of about your cultural identity and what does that mean? Mm-hmm. But I don't really know what that means to me because my cultural identity is like a rejection of the previous culture so that I could fit in.
So it's a couple generations removed. You have to like... But you can't completely ignore that part of your heritage is a heritage of erasure.
Right.
And it is a conscious decision to erase.
Yeah.
So that is something that has to be not just negotiated, but like navigated through, you know, which is, it's tough. I mean, I have to accept things about my own life. Like I have to accept the fact that my sister and I made a rather strange and in hindsight, really poorly informed decision when we were moving from Taiwan back to Canada. And I guess the abbreviated version of what happened was we were living in Saudi Arabia. My father was teaching English there in the universities. My mother became very ill because of allergies. And it was a life-threatening situation. The doctor said, you have to leave immediately. You cannot stay here any longer. Your health and life is threatened. So she took my sister and I, moved to Taiwan, and we waited 9 months for my father to finish his contract.
Right.
In those 9 months, my sister and I completely switched over to Mandarin, forgot all the English that we had learned. And when my father arrived, we couldn't communicate with him.
Right.
And this was a traumatic experience. We didn't know what to do. And so apparently my sister and I decided to completely stop speaking Mandarin until we had regained our English.
Right.
And in hindsight, you go, what a missed opportunity. Yeah. I could have kept this language and a proximity to that culture for a much longer period of my life. And instead, I had to wait until I was 19 years old to go back to Taiwan and relearn the language.
Yeah.
And I think about like all this missed opportunities. And yet, that choice and that heritage of having lost a language and regained a language is also part of who I am.
Right.
And I would not be the person I am or the writer I am without that experience.
Yeah. There's a way that it's informed who you are now. And like if you hadn't lost it, maybe you wouldn't have gone back or it would have completely changed your dynamic with the language to begin with, or English, or your father.
Yeah, so many things were wrapped up in that. And it does kind of, you know, it reveals certain things to you as you think about it. It's like, what was really important about that? But you're right. I think it did change my relationship not only to Mandarin, but it changed my relationship to English.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially after I relearned the language, you know, I came back and I was like, my own relationship to English, you know, after 2 years in Taiwan was different.
Right.
And so I thought that was, you know, but it's really powerful. This, I think like this type of, you know, proximity and erasure and trying to reclaim, you know, I talked about this earlier, like our earlier conversation with Genevieve. We kind of explore this idea of it being somehow connected to elegy. And I really feel like a lot of translation is the work of elegy, is a type of recognition of loss and a mourning for something that we know it was there but is missing, that comes out of a place of love frequently, or at least a tenderness there.
Yeah.
We want to reconnect to it. But we don't always know what it is that we've lost. Sometimes it's just like it's also like a type of amnesia or a type of Alzheimer's, where we're like, we used to know this and it's now fuzzier and we don't know how exactly to name this thing that we have lost.
And it's always sort of imperfect, right? That's the beauty and also sort of like the fallacy of translation, where it just never exactly adds up. Mm. And so you're struggling to reconcile two worlds that use different words, and they never are going to completely perfectly match, but you really, really want them to, so that they'll suddenly, everything will make sense.
Right. And that yearning that is at the center there, are trying to tie those things together, that's poetry.
Yeah, I agree.
We're almost out of time here. So I was wondering, before we go out, where can people find your book or more information about your projects that you're working on?
Yeah, you can buy You're So Trippin' at Powell's. I also, the small press that I work at, we have a website called Dim Summer Book Club, and you could get more of publications that we've done or my books there as well. Also online, you can find me at Julian Smuggles on any social media. I've got it all. I'm the only one that exists. If you Google me, I'm the only one that shows up. So Adidas, get at me.
Looking for a sponsorship.
Yeah, that'd be tight.
It's been such a delight to have you on, Julian. Thank you so much for being here and being part of this wonderful conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's been wonderful to be here. Thank you all for tuning in to Poetry Potluck Radio Hour. I'm your host, Neil Akin, and this is KBOO-FM. We've had on tonight Geneva Chow, and Julian Smuggles. Stay tuned for the next program.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Up next, it's the Radio Evangelism Hour, where we discuss issues of morality, Christianity, and the American way.
Views expressed by guests are not necessarily those of the broadcasting network.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to the Radio Evangelism Hour. Tonight we discuss God and Donald Trump and why it's important that we conservative Christians continue to support Donald Trump.
Our special guests this evening are Dr. Tevlin Ocean from Bob Jones University and